On this episode of That Was a Show, the famous Teddy Z was a show. Baby John Cryer stars as Teddy Zakalakis, the young, bumbling agent of an eccentric and evil movie star inspired by Marlon Brando. Bryn, Aaron, and Barry discuss this sitcom's sharp commentary and dull character development. They call their surly friend Mr. Producer for hot Hollywood insider tea, but instead just learn about snacks. This episode might make you want to work in a bakery. Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince, but those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
All right, so,
okay, let's do this.
Let's do this thing. Let's podcast it up. Do a little podcast-a-roo.
Yeah.
All right. Bryn, tell us about the famous Teddy Z.
Oof. All business. Just jumping right in.
Or is it Teddy Z? We're a Canadian podcast.
It's Teddy Z. Come on.
It's Teddy Z.
I'm asking. I'm just asking.
We grew up too close. I'm a solid. I'm a Z. I've always been a Z guy. I think we grew up too close
to the
States.
Windsor people. Yeah. You say Z, you use Fahrenheit. It's a whole other thing.
We're very Americanized.
I'm a hard Z.
Yeah.
Hard Z.
Okay. Well, you know, you're more Canadian than us, obviously.
That is very true.
All right. So, yeah. So the famous Teddy Z was, in fact, a show. It was created by Hugh Wilson for CBS and aired from September 1989 to May of 1990. We watched the pilot episode and episode 17. So the show is about Theodore Teddy Zakalakis, a naive young man from a tight-knit Greek family. In the pilot, we meet Teddy in the midst of working a temp gig in the mailroom of a Hollywood talent agency called the Unlimited Talent Agency. We find out that he did a stint in the army and took this temp gig all to put off his inevitable destiny of working in his uncle's bakery. So Teddy is basically a fish out of water amongst his aggressive young mailroom counterparts, but somehow he manages to charm the higher-ups with his lack of an agenda and his genuine nature. After a series of fateful events, Teddy is appointed as the agent of eccentric Hollywood actor Harlan Kivo, and he is forced to bumble his way through his new career. The premise of the show is actually based on real events. Teddy is based on Jay Cantor, who was plucked from the mailroom of MCA to become Marlon Brando's agent. The cast includes a very young John Cryer as the titular Teddy, Jane Sibbett as an ambitious aspiring agent and Teddy's crush, Lori, Milton Seltzer as UTA's CEO, Abe Werfinder, Alex Rocco as UTA senior partner, Al Floss, Tom LaGrua as mailroom boss, Richie, Josh Blake as Teddy's younger brother, Ari, Erica Yon as Teddy's grandmother, and Dennis Lipscomb as Marlon Brando. Harlan Kivo. They produced 20 episodes, but only 15 actually made it to air. Despite being yanked off the air very quickly, it was nominated for 4 Emmys for writing, based on the pilot, of course, and directing. They also got nominated for Best Guest Actress for Liz Torres, and Alex Rocco actually won for Best Supporting Actor.
It's a great performance.
It is.
I get it. I mean, Alex Rocco was definitely like my highlight for the pilot.
Wait, which character does he play?
He's Al Floss.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he's he's putting 110%
totally
into that.
Totally. And he's just kind of an icon. Like, he's just one of those characters.
He's Mo Green.
He's Mo Green. Yes.
Yeah. I always think of him as he plays on The Simpsons. He plays basically the exact same character, but he plays Roger Meyer Jr., the guy who's in charge of Itchy and Scratchy.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's funny.
Yeah. All right. So let's just take it from the beginning and talk about the pilot. What did you guys think of the pilot?
Well, it begins with a direct-to-camera speech where Teddy Z is looking straight into the camera and he's describing the premise of the show. And although we're going to save our discussion, in generally speaking, of episode 17 until a bit later, I do think it's worth noting now that they open episode 17 with the same type of direct-to-camera speech. It's evolved because there's a few extra details in terms of how his character has evolved over the course of the season, but it seems
it's the exact same one.
It's slightly different.
What's different?
Yeah, what's different?
It's the exact same one. Because the first one is so out of place because it describes the events of the pilot before you watch them.
But the episode 17 one seems to be in the context of he's now an agent.
No, it's the same. It's the exact same.
Really?
Believe me. Because both of them end with, the only trouble is, I don't have the first idea what's going on.
Yeah.
But it seems to be working out for me. And I was just like, you just told me the entire plot of the show in 10 seconds.
Now,
why am I watching a pilot?
Well, then that being said, I'm my mistake. If that's the case and the speech is the same every time, then I definitely don't like that speech. I mean, if it was a little different in every episode, that I could see being kind of fun.
It's a network note. A lot of network TV shows make them include something that describes the plot. Sometimes you would see this basically in the opening credit sequence where you would have the main character just, you know, describe exactly, you know, think the beginning of Ghost Rider or something like that. You know,
he's a ghost and he writes to us.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Ghost Rider.
Well,
what a trip.
Back to the plot of the pilot. I will say this is the first time I've seen the mailroom scenario as far as like a workplace be presented as like a desirable and highly competitive job. Like, it's a big deal to get to be in this Hollywood agency's mailroom. Mm-hmm. And they even have more expository dialogue explaining how you climb the ladder. Like, it's a big deal that you're starting in the mailroom and the scrappiest, like, best people from the mailroom might get to be a secretary. And then from there, maybe one day you get to be an agent. And like, they really outline it as if like the mailroom of this agency, which the job of someone in a mailroom has no connection to the skill set required for being an agent or manager.
Yeah.
Well, it's the Hollywood dream, which is like only a fraction aside from the American dream, right?
Yeah.
It is everybody can make it if you just put yourself out there. What I thought was funny about this is that they actually were sort of commenting on how bullshit that is.
Yeah.
Because everybody in that mailroom got it because they had connections already, which is funny because like, that's how show business works. You basically only get a job if you have a connection, even the worst jobs.
But the thing,
everybody is commenting on Teddy Z being there because they're like, who's this guy?
How did he even get in here? Yeah.
He doesn't know anybody. Why is he in the mailroom? As in like anything in his life would preclude him from being able to work in a mailroom.
Yeah. But the thing about that, here's what I'll say, is I don't love how they made all of those like other mailroom people, like they wrote them all to be douchebags and sharks. Like they couldn't have been normal kids from middle class backgrounds.
Because that's not who works those jobs.
It's frustrating though. And then it was almost like, these guys are just a bunch of suckers. And Teddy's like the real hero. But I don't love when people like bumble into these like jobs.
My beef with it is not so much the other people in the mailroom, where I do think like if you're telling the story in a comedic way of what it's like at one of these agencies, it makes sense that it's a bunch of people that are there because of nepotism.
Yeah.
And in the context of a sitcom, they're being presented as antagonistic to the main character. So I'm not so much bothered by them, but I share your beef with Teddy because he doesn't even know what an agent does. He doesn't even know what this company does. And someone who like doesn't even really understand why they're there, kind of tripping and falling ass backwards into a sweet gig, a sort of Kramer type of move, if you will, that is annoying to specifically position that person as the hero, as if it's like, it's laudable and admirable that people who don't know what they're doing and have no idea why they're there are able to get these great opportunities.
Yeah.
But that's the joke. That's the whole joke, is that he doesn't know what he's doing. It's not aspirational. The whole thing is like, this industry is
frustrating.
Bullshit.
Right. I get that's the joke, but I guess my feeling is, if this were a feature film, if this was a movie comedy about someone who ends up becoming a Hollywood agent because they were some temp who came out of the army, got some temp job, doesn't even know what this company does, and then they end up becoming the agent for a big time celebrity who's really difficult to manage. Mm-hmm. I see how that works as the plot of a movie. But as a sitcom that supposedly would be designed to last for 150 episodes, I don't know how I'm supposed to care about him over a long span of time.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a long arc. I mean, eventually he would get good at what he was doing.
Right.
And he'd be a good agent. It's a long arc, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even at the end of the season, you see that he's a little bit better, mm-hmm. but he's still pretty clueless, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would like it. And yeah, he shows like a little bit of fanboying at the beginning. Like he does like talk about celebrities and how it's like really neat to be there. So he does have that kind of appreciation of it. But I think I would have liked it more if maybe it was something he wanted to do all along, but he just didn't think it was possible. And then he just kind of stumbled into it and he was like, oh, all right, well, I'm going to take this opportunity. Like I always wanted to work in show business, but I didn't know it was like possible. Like I would have liked that more if it was like I scammed my way into this.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel the same way. Like him bumbling into the job is fine, but it would have been nice if he was like someone who loved movies as a kid and was super obsessed with wanting to work in Hollywood one day, but just never thought it would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a version of this that works, but the version of it doesn't have it as a joke, right? The whole thing is meant to be a takedown of the industry. Right from him just being a clueless idiot, right? Like everybody, I was kind of impressed that the satire like extent, like nobody in this is genuine. Nobody in this is like just like in it for the love of anything. Every single one of these characters is a complete shill. This definitely comes from somebody frustrated working in Hollywood.
True. It is a genuine satire, and to the degree where it's amazing that a show like this got greenlit.
Well,
when you have to imagine the number of agents who work in a company like that who had to be okay with this show getting made.
And and it's funny because we'll get to talking about this when we talk about episode 17, which is essentially about a network script coming into fruition.
That plot is great.
It's so
all
good.
I could think about was if this is the version that made it to the air. How dark was the original version?
Right? Like, how many scary, like, Me Too moments before?
What was the first draft of that episode?
Yeah. So it was interesting in that. Like, I mean, I found it more interesting than anything. I unfortunately, like, you know, at the end of the day, I didn't really laugh very much. And I still don't look like John Cryer. Sorry, future guest of the show, John Cryer. I'm not a huge fan.
I did like, so I'm more cool with like young John Cryer. Like I find, I hate
Ducky. I want to go on the record. I hate Ducky.
Yeah.
And I've never gotten over Ducky.
He's a very divisive character for sure. Ducky, Aaron, do you know what we're talking about?
I do not.
His character from Pretty in Pink. It was his most iconic role at this point in his young career. The thing that I really liked, I love the scenes with his grandmother. Like, I actually did find them pretty clever. Because basically, as we mentioned, he's under a lot of pressure from his family to join the family business and work in his uncle's bakery. And so basically, the main struggle of Teddy in the pilot is whether he's going to continue on this track of working in Hollywood and taking this agent job. Or is he going to just like do what his family wants him to do? So there's a very funny scene with his grandmother who he lives with and his younger brother, where he's explaining to her, you know, like, I have this job and, you know, it seems like a good opportunity. And they're going back and forth. And at the point where he actually puts his foot down and says he's like going to stick with this job, his younger brother, like, she has a knife because she's cooking, and the younger brother just like pulls it, discreetly pulls it off the table.
Yeah, I really found that moment funny. And, yeah. and I will say, like, I found that the show, like, talking about the pilot at the moment, it has some cheesy bits.
It's cheesy.
But I did find some of it funny. And here's what I'm kind of reflecting on, is that the shows from that era that we do like and that we do have a memory of thinking are like great shows, we're judging them not based on their pilot or even generally their first season, but, you know, the collective accomplishments of those shows, and especially once they're a few years into it. So, you know, in the case of a show like this, where there's elements of it that make me feel like it has some potential, I'm trying to be a little more generous than I usually am and think about this as like, okay, I'm judging this in its sort of early stages. It's the first episode. It doesn't have to be perfect. I found as a pilot from 1989 that it was okay. It was pretty good. It would make me want to watch more of it. I liked the scene with the family. And I also kind of want to call out, though, this is a thing where it's like I half liked this and half disliked this. The scene that introduces the Al Floss character.
Yeah.
It's a good scene and he delivers a strong performance. I mean, generally speaking, every time we see him in this show, he's putting everything into it. He's firing on all cylinders. But that scene did feel like it was just shoehorned in there as a showcase for this actor. Like,
yeah.
Look who we got. We're going to give him a little bit of time to just take the stage and shine. And it ends with the whole give plenty of room for the audience to laugh and respond because they've really enjoyed getting to see this guy that they recognize do the thing that you bring him out to a show to do. And I don't like, to be honest, I don't like when shows do that, when it's very obvious that it's like, we're just, here's part of the stage play that we're going to show to you where this guy does his thing.
These are sitcoms, Aaron. That's what their primary goal is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I agree that it did feel a little shoehorned in, but like reflecting on it now, I'm realizing, you know, that whole scene, it was dragged out to do exactly what you're describing. But I feel like the purpose of it, like that little initial pulling him in the office, was to for him to like suss out why the CEO of the company was taking an interest in him.
I agree.
And so it was like all like the BS that goes on in those types of offices, all the politics where, you know, he's like, who's this kid and why is he talking to you know,
no, I know. Yeah, the scene needed to happen. That conversation between them needed to happen.
But you're saying it was too long.
They made such a meal out of it.
They made too much of a meal.
It just, you know what it reminded me of in the show that I hesitate to name, but in Davis Rules. What was the actor?
Oh, great. Now this episode just tanked.
Tanked. No one's going to listen to this
because
now.
Because we're referencing Davis Rules. No one likes Davis Rules.
But who's the actor that I'm thinking of? The older actor who was in that
Jonathan
show?
Jonathan Winters.
Jonathan Winters.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing.
The way they treat him in this show is like the way they treated Jonathan Winters in that show, where it really felt like, look who we got.
Yeah.
I genuinely, any scene Alex Rocco was in this, I was just enjoying like extensively. So I didn't really notice that. He didn't like Winters annoyed me, but because I was distinctively not a fan of Winters's type of comedy.
Yeah.
Whereas Alex Rocco's type of comedy, I was enjoying quite a bit. Like him as a Hollywood sleazebag is just funny to me. What I did not like was, and I can't remember the actor or the character name because it wasn't a good character name. The guy who played Brando?
Yeah.
Did nothing for me. And like the
Harlan
scene
Kivo.
Where they... Harlan Kivo. He did nothing for me. He could have been a scene stealer.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
totally.
He wasn't.
Totally.
They just
totally.
Made him just ugly and like just like hate filled. And like, I don't see the point of having that character in a sitcom.
Yeah.
Like,
I know.
I get that you want to take down Hollywood a bit, but like, this guy's going to be reoccurring. Don't make me just loathe him. Like, yeah. He's not even a villain. Like, he's gross. Like, I mean, he's very Brando, but. Yeah.
Like, shouldn't the sitcom have been the dynamic between Teddy and this eccentric actor? Like, shouldn't that have been?
That dynamic happens off camera.
Yeah.
We barely get that.
In the two episodes we watched.
In the two episodes we watched.
If he's part of the main cast, I guess
he's not, though. He's considered recurring.
Okay. Well, I'm glad because he doesn't work.
No,
so
I know. He's not
maybe
great.
Maybe they wrote him out after the pilot.
It feels like they just slotted in an actor that.
No. I mean, they talk about him a lot in episode 17.
They talk about him, but it's, you know, like.
But he's not there.
He's not there visually.
Yeah, no, they just slotted in a guy that was like, oh, can you give kind of a cartoonish, you know, impression of like a Marlon Brando type and like.
I feel like we should give a little context to the listeners for the scene.
Okay.
Like what actually happens.
Yeah.
So this famous Hollywood actor who's supposedly one of the greatest living legends, he's described as, like, there's an introduction where this guy's flying in from Europe, where he lives most of the time, and he's flying in, he's represented by this agency, so Al Floss is his agent. He's flying in, and someone needs to pick him up from the airport, and Al Floss is making a big deal about how he's so important and he needs to be treated really well. And it's really important that we like get him from the airport. And when Al Floss is asked, like, well, why don't you go pick him up? And he's just like, I'm not spending an hour in a car with that psychopath. And we haven't seen who this person is. We don't know what this is a reference to. But then what ends up happening is Teddy Z ends up, you know, shit flows downhill. And Teddy Z ends up being the one who has to go to the airport and pick up this actor. And there's a bunch of like paparazzi outside the airport who've been tipped off that this guy's arriving. And he comes out with his scarf and sunglasses and everything. And he goes into a limo with Teddy Z. And this guy is just, he's like throwing cameras at people's faces, and punching them. And just like, he's aggressive and violent and nasty, and they get in the limo and he's just nonstop mean to Teddy. Yeah.
But not funny mean.
No,
just
not
mean.
Funny mean.
Just mean.
Mean mean.
Yeah. And then Teddy stands up to him, basically. And that's what wins Harlan over and why Harlan is suddenly drawn to this young guy and wants him to be his agent based on nothing but the fact that Teddy stood up to him.
Yeah, they got in a fist
fight. Which is funny because it's all off camera. Because
they don't show any of it. They explain later that he like punched him or he like swung at him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, like that would have been fun to see, you know? Like, I don't understand.
That ruined the plot for me because the scene with the two of them in the back of the limo, we get Harlan shitting on him.
Yeah.
But then when they decide to pull the limo over to like have it out as some sort of fight, that doesn't happen. Cut to commercials, back from commercials, and we're just at the agency and find out that Harlan wants Teddy to be his agent.
So
we get none of it.
The reason, like earlier,
which we also learn in the opening preamble that didn't need to be there because that's in the episode. But hey, it's network television.
Yeah, but so earlier I mentioned how I'm like, well, why wasn't the whole sitcom surrounding this dynamic? And it's like we saw a sitcom where that dynamic existed with Stark Raving Mad.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the Tony Shalhoub and Neil Patrick Harris dynamic where there's this very eccentric, creative character and the person who's having to like rein them in all the time.
That's a much better show.
Much better show. So like this show should have been that, but I think all of these like people involved were like, oh no, we've got to really play up the whole agent thing. We've got to really make fun of our own industry and that's probably what happened in the
it was ultimately wrong for them to caricature a version of Brando and create a totally unlikable actor as this person who is then going to either end up with a lot of the stuff happening off camera or just write them out, when what they could have done is had an actor who is talented and has aspects of them that are interesting, but they're just difficult. And like they could have had a more even-handed dynamic. And you still could have had the thing where this eccentric actor chooses Teddy as their new agent because they like the idea of someone who stands up to them. They could have still done that, but it needed to be someone that we want to spend time with.
Right. But that's like, yeah, that's like a popular trope as well, where this like...
I was going to say, to be contrarian, like, I've seen that show a million times.
Yeah, it is. I mean, but it's also one of those things, like, someone like Marlon Brando would have made a snap decision like that, where it's like, I'm fascinated. Yeah. He literally did. And it's like, I'm fascinated by this young person, and I just want to be around them. I don't care if they run my career into the ground. I'm going to decide, because I'm an egomaniac, that they are my agent now. And it's like,
but it's interesting, you know, that he's only in the one scene in the pilot, because you're right, we never see a single hint in that scene that he even tolerates being around this guy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's really bizarre. Yeah. The whole thing's really
and
weird.
Also, it's not like Harlan gets a glimpse from Teddy that Teddy's even aspiring to be an agent. Teddy's just some kid who works in the mailroom who's picking him up from the airport. It's not like Teddy's talking about how, you know, he has great ideas for movies and how he's going to be such a great agent. But like, I get to your point, like, yes, that type of character dynamic has been done to death. But I'm evaluating it in a 1989 perspective, that had they written that character differently in 1989, I feel like that is one of the linchpins that could have made this show work.
If you had a good, I agree, if you had a good caliber actor in that role, like somebody really fun to watch, yeah, you got something going there.
So once the strange decision is made that Teddy is going to be Harlan's agent, they have to kind of figure out the new, you know, dynamic of everything. And they're ironing out all the details in a very hasty way. Amongst the senior partners, like Al Floss and Abe, and they're all like just kind of spitballing what's going to happen. And they're like, okay, so you're going to make $50,000 a year, and you're going to need a secretary. And Teddy immediately offers up Lori, which is like just very problematic. Like, and I was like cringing as soon as I saw that.
You mean the girl who had rejected him constantly in the entire episode, and now he's going to make her his subordinate? What's problematic about that?
Yeah. Nothing at all. Now that you meant say it that way.
Yeah, it's really gross and cringy.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I feel like at the time they probably hoped that would play well for audiences, and maybe in 1989 a lot of people wouldn't have bumped on that because they established already in dialogue that people who were in the mailroom aspire to climb the ladder, and the next rung on the ladder is secretary. So it is implied.
That's a good move for her.
She would want to be a secretary, but not his secretary.
Agreed.
The fact that he wants her to be his secretary, and you can see it on his face, is clearly just so he can hit on her relentlessly.
Yeah.
However, episode 17, which this is called a segue.
Yes.
Episode 17 does actually show that this dynamic does change in that she essentially uses Teddy as a bit of a puppet master. She knows she needs to work her way up, and this kid has somehow done it. So she is the one kind of running the show.
She's pulling all the strings from behind the scenes.
I do like that a lot. I agree. Yeah. But
They do not appear to have a will they won't they, which I also appreciated.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I like that. I like that too, Barry. That's a great point.
It is a very good point.
So they do make up for it, but that initial moment, I got so mad. I think I was like red in the face. I was like, oh, you.
I was so mad. In the pilot, it's brutal. And thank God that character relationship goes where it goes in episode 17.
Yeah.
Agreed. And the only thing that even mildly saves it in the pilot, which doesn't because it's still very icky and cringy, is that at least Teddy isn't a sleazy character. Like, he is pretty much just a grown-up child.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not worried in that. Yeah. In that moment, I'm not worried. I'm just like, why did you do this?
He's silly. He's sleazy without intending to be sleazy, like the character Ducky.
good call. Good call. But yeah, she ends up being a lot more of a Joan Holloway than a Mrs. Blankenship. So
you're very right.
On that note, I did find myself thinking about this particular analysis when I was watching the show. And, you know, this note applies to both the pilot and episode 17, but especially the pilot, even though you had a great segue there.
I was like, guys, I segued us.
I know you did this. I don't want to not commit to the segue, but I do just want to say, and this sort of applies to all of this, that in a drama like Mad Men, we accept characters as being gross because they're part of a world where we know that that is intrinsic to the world that we're examining. Mm-hmm. And we hold bad behavior against the characters because we know this world is commenting on that world. In a sitcom, even one like this, where we know that it is a satire, if characters are gross and misogynistic, it's hard to help but hold it against the show. Even if the show has made it very clear, this show is out to take down this environment and the people in this environment are all kind of shitty. When they are shitty, we still kind of hold it against the show. And it's interesting to me. I don't necessarily have an opinion on that. I just think it's interesting that that is an instinct we tend to have with sitcoms that we don't tend to have with dramas.
I see exactly what you're saying there. And I agree with it being a 1980s show. Modern day, you might see something like this and know that they're making a comment on it. Audiences are treated a little bit smarter nowadays.
You're right. A multi-cam 80s or 90s sitcom.
Sure. But even then, even in the 80s, and you're right, they are not making a comment on this. They are basically just being like, look how stupid the industry is. But they're not necessarily like, it shouldn't be this way. They're just like, look how silly everything is here.
Yeah, you're right. And it is a subtle distinction, but it's an important distinction. And also, like, when a character like Al Floss is misogynistic, because of the way that actor performs it, we kind of get that he is representing a specific archetype that is known to be really gross.
And Teddy's reaction to him being gross is sort of like, yeah, he's gross, whatever.
When Teddy either says something gross or reacts to something in a gross way, it's hard to forgive it in terms of forgiving the show. Like it's more something where you're going to hold it against the show and be like, oh, why did they do that? Because Teddy is supposed to be the one who's a fish out of water. Yeah. He should not have any of those traits. So when he does have any of them, it's like,
he has so many ducky traits. God damn it.
He does.
So episode 17, like we said, begins with another straight to camera opening monologue, which apparently I was mistaken is exactly the same as in the pilot, and some really sassy saxophone.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And let's not forget, I feel like every episode we don't go on about theme music enough, because a lot of the shows we watch have really annoying theme songs, and this one is definitely no exception.
Yeah.
Oh man,
it is very of its time.
You can, and this is on YouTube, so feel free to do a quick little look for the opening credits of The Famous Teddy Z, or in all of my notes, The Fantabulous Teddy Z.
Yeah. So as we referenced earlier in this episode, Lori really kind of shines in this because she's definitely the puppet master and she's the one sort of like actually making the big moves. And so what happens is she brings in this producer team that are people that she knows. So it's all her that's like bringing in this producer team as potential new clients for Teddy. Because at this point, he literally only has Harlan as his client. And so this producer team comes in and they start pitching their idea and they really want somebody to represent them to help them get this project to networks. And it's supposed to be this like very gritty, like,
Yeah, they're the thriller. The producer team. It's like a, I think like a couple, like a husband and wife.
They're a husband and wife team. She's the writer. He's the director.
Yeah. And they made some documentary that did well in festivals, and they're supposed to be like impressive, artistic.
They won an Oscar. They're also Oscar winners.
Okay. So they get introduced as these very legitimate artistic filmmakers with a documentary background who are very passionate about telling a story about CIA agents in Central America with, interesting cultural commentary on the environment. And like, they seem to have some sort of like gritty, dramatic concept.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be a serious subject matter and an important piece, if you will.
Yeah.
And
they're selling an hour long drama.
Yes. Yeah. So they're their first foray into like fictional, scripted content. But it's like, you know, based on like serious events that are unfolding in the world. So basically, yeah. So Teddy helps them Lori helps them get meetings. And basically what happens is a series of meetings where the network people take their idea and completely transform it into what ends up being like a half hour sitcom.
And like, it doesn't make it less funny, because even going in, you're like, by the end of this is going to be a sitcom. And yeah. I still was along for the ride. I was still enjoying every weird turn it took.
I totally agree. It's obvious where they're going with this premise right from the get-go. Like, oh, we're going to see how the meat grinder of the network and the agency change their idea. But they take that premise so far and they show how the sausage is made to such an extent that it actually like is very entertaining as a plot, because it's that thing of people just spontaneously spitballing. So it's a bunch of people in a room, and it's the classic like, but does it have to be the CIA? Where do we have to shoot it there? And it always starts with like someone asking a question and then coming up with a possible answer. And then someone else who outranks them loving that idea. And the husband and wife duo, they're just sitting in the corner listening as like passive spectators to
they're
this.
They're just like letting their idea.
Their soul withering away
they're letting their idea get completely bastardized because they just really want an opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, and it has such a great payoff on both sides of the spectrum where they compromise so much and end up with a sitcom about, you know, two women living together with a family and an imaginary angel. That has nothing to do with anything they were talking about.
Two women who are FBI agents living together in LA, and there's a kid with an imaginary friend
who's an angel.
Named Pinky.
Named Pinky.
And the best thing is obviously they submit the script, you know, compromising every step of the way, and the network hates it because they thought they were buying something gritty. And then they were getting a gritty drama, even though every single idea was theirs, and they give them exactly what they want, and they still say it's terrible.
And then
it has the other payoff of like Teddy tries to stand up for them and be like, these are serious artists. They want to do this thing. They're not gonna compromise anymore for you. And then they're like pretty much in the background being like, cha-ching, like, yeah, sure we will, no problem.
We don't care. But the funny thing about it too is like once like they get rejected.
Yeah.
And then Teddy's like, well, we're going to take this idea somewhere else then. And then they're like, well, no, we own this idea now. Like the network is like,
these are all our ideas.
yeah.
And then he's like, but you're saying you don't like it. Yes, they're our ideas and we hate them.
And it's funny because technically this couple could go and pitch their original idea somewhere else because it does not resemble at all what was come up with. I enjoyed that Al Floss's big contribution was making sure that the women always wore cutoff jeans and halter tops.
And they lived with a trained porpoise that helps them solve crimes.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, all of it was like pretty clever because it is like, it is very like ridiculous, and it is like a legit criticism of how these things happen. And I also liked the little beat where they're having their final meeting to like where the network is basically going to shut down the project. Yeah. And they like Teddy calls them up and she's like, are you on speakerphone? And he's like, no, but like the producers are in the room. So is Lori. Everybody's like in the room.
Yeah.
And so he lies and says no. And then he's like, are you? And she says no. But then it's like full of like all the producers and the staff writers. It's a great cut.
It's a perfect edit. Yeah. It's a perfect cut too. Cuts to her. No.
Yeah.
It's a really good cut. The second episode, I think, shows a lot more of what this show could be. And you're right. I enjoyed it a lot more. There was a few really good gags. That one actually getting an audible like, oh, hey, that's good.
The funny thing is this episode actually didn't air because they only made 20 episodes and 15 aired. And this is episode number 17.
They didn't even burn. Yeah. They didn't even burn them off. Huh?
No. Wow. And it's a better episode. And the thing in my research that I saw is that everyone considered this pilot to be so good. And that's what like got nominated for the Emmy. And that the subsequent episodes were not as good. We're not viewed as good. But I'm like, I'm looking at this episode, episode 17, and thinking like, actually, this was like funny. I got a few chuckles and it was clever, way more clever.
Way better than the pilot.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it clearly they had no faith in this show whatsoever. And they really just like yanked it before it could have done anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And this episode kind of introduces so the head of the mailroom is still in the mix somehow. Like, I don't know how the mail comes into play.
Yeah.
But like he has this like reoccurring gag that is just like a studio note, but pretty much works all the time, which is basically like he comes in, tells a joke about show business, and leaves.
Yeah.
And he ends the episode with like my first actual like out loud laugh.
Yeah, I liked that joke.
I was like, oh, the last thing that I actually watched this show actually made me laugh for once. And it was like, he goes, hey kid, he goes, how many network executives does it take to change a light bulb? And Teddy's like, oh, I don't know, man. How many? And he goes, well, first of all, does it have to be a light bulb?
Yeah. That's a solid joke. Yeah. Solid button too.
And it's a good it really ties the themes of the episodes together. Good laugh really line does. To go out on.
The idea of a one-liner joke that sort of summarizes what we've just learned about the world from the plot of the episode. It's great.
Yeah.
Also, like early in that episode, Teddy has his like desk. He's now an agent and he has his little office, and I think it was, I can't remember which character came in and gives him a Rolodex.
Same guy.
I love this, how it's like the latest technology. This Rolodex for keeping, because he had like a card file that was a bunch of loose note cards in a plastic box. And he's being given this Rolodex that's like the hot new technology for organizing your contacts.
which even in 89 was not true. I mean, Rolodexes have been around since like the 50s, if not before.
But that is funny. And then he says you can transfer all of your contacts to this, but Teddy doesn't have any contacts. He doesn't know anyone. His card file is completely empty. And in that moment, there's a shot where he's just sort of, he gets the Rolodex and he's just sort of sitting alone at his desk, kind of spinning it, not knowing what to do. And it was such a George Costanza moment when George gets a job and he's just filling a chair.
Yeah.
It's like when he gets the Penske file he doesn't even know why he's there.
It's a real Tommy Boy playing with his fan.
Luke, I am your father.
That's from Star Wars.
I also feel like it's worth noting that the plot of episode 17 of that show is basically the premise for our podcast.
Pretty much.
I was impressed that they actually went far enough with the satirical commentary. I was impressed that from the pilot to episode 17, there was real growth, and it seemed like the show was getting progressively better. There was some well-written dialogue that was actually kind of funny. For me, the biggest con is, unfortunately, Teddy himself, because he feels like too weak of a protagonist. The whole thing of him being like charmingly befuddled
doesn't quite carry enough water for me. And a lot of the plot happens around him. There were these things that are happening, and it's kind of fun to watch that trajectory in episode 17, but it just doesn't really feel like Teddy needs to be there for any of that to happen. And the dynamic between Teddy and Lori is good in episode 17 in the sense of where she gets developed to as a character, mm-hmm. but he is still kind of feeling like a bookmark holding a place for a character that's a little bit more developed in some way. So it just feels like he's barely present in these stories that are happening adjacent to him.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
But this is the most 50-50 on the fence I've ever been about one of the shows that we've reviewed, where yeah. I'm like, would I want to watch more of this? Maybe.
I'll agree with you on that, in that I think that, so there's a fairly well-trucked internet theory about the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is that Indiana Jones, being the main character, does not really impact the plot. Everything would go along exactly as it would happen whether Indiana Jones was there or not. It's my favorite movie. I disagree. But that is sort of what is happening here with Teddy. He is definitely in every scene, but very seldom does he propel the plot forward. In fact, you're exactly right. Things happen around him, and I don't know how much narrative push that really has. Like, how long do I watch a character who does not really have drive and does not, like, I don't know what he's about. I don't know what he's trying to accomplish. True. Yeah, so I agree with you there. And yeah, I'll say the same thing. If I had pros, I mean, same as yours, really. Just like, you know, a lot of the satire works. Episode 17 is definitely a step forward, and it's a clever takedown of how a script can get broken down by a network.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you want to watch more of this show?
I might. I'm curious now. To watch at least like the last episode that aired to see if it was really that bad that they thought they couldn't show any more of them. Especially because this one was much better.
Yeah.
Episode 17.
I caught a little bit of the episode after episode 17. So I guess 18, I don't know if it aired or not, but I did think it was funny in that in the bit of the episode that I saw, Teddy was out for dinner with Alf Loss, and Alf Loss goes on a little bit of a rant about some other guy in Hollywood, and he says something along the lines of, I'd like to see them try to stick a horse's head in that guy's bed.
Because he's Mo Green.
And I was just like, that's a nice, fun little callback there.
So, Bryn, why don't you tell us about 6 degrees of friends for the famous Teddy Z?
Well,
well, there's a good one.
Yeah, well, this one is like obvious and straightforward. basically, yeah, the famous Teddy Z was separated from the iconic sitcom Friends by 1 degree. And that is, of course, through Jane Sibbett, who played not only Lori in Lori Parr in Teddy Z, but she also played Carol Willick, aka Ross Geller's ex-wife in Friends.
Well, that was easy enough.
Real easy.
And what about the spinoff?
Yeah, I mean, the spinoff is also pretty straightforward as well. Like, everybody that was involved in this show, like, already had, like, very active careers in film and television. So, obviously, we have John Cryer, who played Teddy. He's already established as a young actor in both films and television. He continued to get roles and actually had two other short-lived 90s sitcoms called Partners and Getting Personal. He wasn't the star of either of those. He was like in the main cast. He also worked steadily throughout the 90s and early aughts, but then landed his biggest role in TV to date as Alan Harper on 2 and a Half Men.
Ugh, I wish he had another half short-lived sitcom.
Yeah. And then most recently, he played Lex Luthor in Supergirl. And, you know, he had an episode of The Kominsky Method. So he's, you know, he's still at it. He's still doing his thing. We also have Jane Sibbett, and we also referenced her pretty much most iconic role, which was Carol on Friends. So she plays, of course, Ross Geller's ex-wife and one half of one of the first, you know, queer couples in a mainstream sitcom. So it's kind of she has kind of a cool legacy that way. She is definitely one of these really prolific character actors who kind of pops in and out of things in supporting roles on TV and lots of, you know, made for TV movies and things like that. Also, one fun thing to mention is right before she was on Friends, she was on Herman's Head, which is a show everyone asks us to cover.
Yeah.
And I'm still debating whether we should, because technically it ran for like 3 seasons. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we'll get to Herman's Head one of these days.
We will definitely do Herman's Head. This podcast will get to Herman's Head.
Yeah. So Alex Rocco, who, of course, we already talked about quite a bit. He played Mo Green in The Godfather. And, you know, he... After Teddy Z, he didn't get slowed down at all. He continued to have lots of success in film and television. He also had a couple other, like, sort of one-hit wonder, short-lived sitcoms. Sibs, which I think we should cover.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Followed up by a role in The George Carlin Show. Barry mentioned earlier already that he did a voice on The Simpsons, the reoccurring role of Roger Myers Jr., and he had several, you know, reoccurring TV roles up until his death in 2015.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also wanted to give a special shout out to someone who's not in the main cast, but who was nominated for an Emmy for her guest star role on the famous Teddy Z. And that's Liz Torres. So you guys might remember her from our episode about the John Larroquette Show. So she played Mahalia.
Okay.
In the John Larroquette Show. So she has such an amazing career. Like, she's definitely a TV comedy icon. Like, she started working like in the 70s. She had a role in All in the Family and in Phyllis. And, you know, a lot of millennials know her as Miss Patty on the Gilmore Girls, which in my opinion is the best character on that show.
Okay. And what does she play on Teddy Z?
She's in 2 episodes and she plays Teddy's Aunt Angie.
Okay.
So it's not in either of the episodes that we watched.
And does she play it very Greek?
I don't know, because I didn't watch it, but they nominated her for an Emmy, so it must be pretty good.
Because that's one thing we didn't really talk about is that Teddy, I mean, he has a very Greek sounding last name. There's nothing about his character per se that plays it that way, but that scene in the pilot with the grandmother and the younger brother, those characters play it like a scene from My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a furniture wrapped in plastic joke for sure.
Oh yeah. Big time.
Yeah. Well, seeing as how this show is kind of about the world of a Hollywood agency, and episode 17 is about the machinations of network television in the late 80s, I think it's probably incumbent on us to check in with Mr. Producer to see if he has anything to add to this conversation.
I hope that jackass picks up the phone this week. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Producer.
Hey, kid. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Sorry we missed each other last week.
Last week?
Didn't you get my message?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry about that. I was screening my calls. That bum Bobby Zemeckis was calling me nonstop.
Robert Zemeckis? Are you guys working on something?
No. He kept hounding me about my cousin Daniel's recipe for caraway seed cake.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, this week on the cast...
On the what?
The podcast. We were talking about the famous Teddy Z.
Ah, yeah, with Johnny Cry Cry. Fantastic project. You know, I still play pickleball with Hugh Wilson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Wilson passed away in 2018.
Ah, that explains the no-shows.
So did you have any involvement with the series?
Ah, no. I stayed far away from that one. Ruffled a lot of feathers.
Because of the deep digs at show business?
Sure. Well, that and Milton Seltzer, he kept his trailer fully stocked with live chickens. You know, for backgammon.
Well, besides that, did you find the behind-the-scenes showbiz humor to be pretty true to life?
Oh, absolutely. Popcorn bowls in every office.
Anything else?
Nah, pretty much just the popcorn bowls.
Oh, so did you say caraway seed cake?
Zemeckis, is that you? Your animated movies are terrifying. Never call this number again.
Well, any leftovers?
I just want to call out the amount of shoulder pads used in this series. It was like peak shoulder pad in 1989. and not even just the women. I would say it actually appeared as though Teddy himself was rocking shoulder pads more than anyone else.
Yeah, definitely.
Boxy coats and shoulders that looked like they were like curtain rods, basically.
Yeah, the broadest shoulders on the thinnest people. Yeah, it's funny. I like how they went with Unlimited Talent Agency so that they could still have the acronym UTA.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and they said that. They called themselves UTA. And I'm like, ooh, wow, you're really like, you're really throwing in there with this parody. Also, my one other leftover is about the house set that we catch a glimpse of in the pilot with the grandmother and the younger brother.
Yeah, what was that?
I found the layout of that set to be really interesting. I don't know if I liked it or disliked it, but it was very different. And it seemed like a deliberate choice that the center of this home was the kitchen table instead of the couch. And the whole house was sort of orbiting around that kitchen table, which also seemed to be like the grandmother's domain and a lot of like food related references there.
But it wasn't a kitchen table. It was like dining room
or dining room.
You don't see the kitchen.
Yeah, like dining room table. Well, it was I guess I said kitchen table because it was like a smaller, rounder table. Yeah. But
it was nonsensical that none of it made sense as a layout for a home of any sort.
It was really odd.
Yeah, it seemed more like a scene from a movie than from a sitcom. Like it was interesting, but ultimately probably not a sustainable choice for a set.
I also I'll point out that and this happens in TV more than you'd expect. But so she's like, oh, dinner's ready. It's in the it's in the oven. Go eat it. Why are you just sitting there chopping onions then? Why are you chopping onions? It's already done. There are so many shows and movies where people have already finished dinner and they're just chopping onions because they think chopping onions is just business. It's not chopping. Onions get chopped to go in things, Grandma.
But
they go in things.
Is it the implication that she's always cooking and maybe she's prepping?
No, it's the implication of they don't...
Ingredients for the next day? I don't know.
No, it's the implication that they don't know what the fuck they're doing. That's
fair
that's
enough.
It's my only F-bomb this week.
That's
my
true,
other,
yeah.
My other leftover was the mail... It's also about the set. The mailroom set in no way looks like a functioning mailroom. It is literally just a room that has a big like table in the middle where people are putting mail. That's I've worked in a mailroom. That's not how a mailroom works. That would not be sustainable.
So we can't really close the episode with a discussion about the sets. Does anyone have any final thoughts or a way to wrap this up?
I mean, I don't know. No, not really. I mean, this is our show, man. We can end the show any way we want. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
And cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show.
Radio Gizmo.